I want to talk about a serious subject today, and one I know will be of benefit to many in the congregation. And the subject is the subject of depression, which you know is a major problem. But I think everybody at some point in their life gets depressed. I'll have to explain it for those who have not been depressed. But I want to begin by remembering, you know, a very serious outcome of depression in the United Kingdom. When I was a pastor over there, I had a 19-year-old who took his own life after his girlfriend broke up with him. And this was my first experience of that within the church, somebody taking their own life, so I still remember it, and it was a very, very sad funeral. He was only 19. I learned a number of things from that. I learned, first of all, that Sunday is the worst day for suicides, because it is the loneliest day of the week. A lot of people are at home by themselves. This relationship had broken up. He was just depressed. He took weed killer. And after he drank this weed killer, of course, then he called his roommate and told him, and the roommate called for an ambulance, and he was pumped out, but it was too late. It was already making its way through to the lungs. He was able to talk, I think, until the Wednesday, 3 or 4 days later. Then he went into a coma and died 2 weeks later. Now, since then, of course, you know, I've had to officiate at funerals for other people who have taken their own lives as a result of serious depression. And I wish to emphasize, most people who are depressed do not take their own lives. But this is just the extreme end of depression. But in the United States, I've known people do that as well. And quite often, over broken relationships. It is a major cause of suicide, broken relationships. Statistically, males are much more likely to take their own life. In fact, statistically, males are more likely to succeed at taking their own life because they usually do something violent with a gun, for example, or something similar, whereas women tend to take pills and are often saved because of the time factor. Somebody, you know, realizes and there's still time to save them. Interestingly, white males are the most likely to take their own lives. African Americans are less likely to take their own lives. One suggestion there is that African Americans tend to be more religious in this country than Anglos are, so that may be a factor there, but not enough research is being done on it. But if it's difficult for you to understand why people would do this or why they would get so depressed over a broken relationship, I want to read to you from a book which deals with male depression. And that book is, and the title is very revealing, I Don't Want to Talk About It. The title says it all, really, because, you know, men don't want to talk about it. Women do talk about it. When women have problems, generally they call other women and share their problems. When guys have problems, they keep them to themselves, generally. You know, women talk 4 times as much as men. I read that. That's not what I'm saying. You know, I'm just saying, I read that somewhere. I mean, I wouldn't know these things, you know, but guys just don't talk about it. So the subtitle of this book is Overcoming the Secret Legacy of Male Depression by Terence Real. I don't want to talk about it is basically the approach that men take. And this is what it says. Now, I'm just using the example of a broken relationship to help, you know, as an introduction here for depression, but I'm not just talking about broken relationships. We're talking about depression. But in this book, he says this, in severe love addiction, when the love object becomes unavailable, the experience of withdrawal can produce symptoms as horrible as any in drug detoxification, including panic attacks, depression, obsession, psychotic breakdown, stalking, murder, and suicide. So in other words, a broken relationship can be as difficult as coming off drugs or giving up cigarettes. You know, which is very, very difficult. And those of you who tried to do it or have done it know just how difficult it can be. You know, often we think of people with physical problems and we can think, we can sympathize with them greatly. But sometimes it's very difficult to sympathize with people who have emotional problems. And depression really is a serious emotional problem. So I want to talk about depression and how to deal with it. Now, most of my focus will be on male depression for two reasons. One is the one that I've already said, that men suffer from it more than women, and the title of the book helps you see why. And secondly, I can speak with some experience. Over the past 4 weeks, while I've had the problem with kidney stones, I've gotten very depressed during the last few weeks. And not only was there the physical pain of the kidney stones, I was also going through a period of considerable overload when it comes to work. And then additionally, there's always the personal issues that we all have to deal with. So, all three things together were kind of triple whammies. And it's been a very difficult month. And I finally found that I felt like I was coming out of it yesterday. So that's good. It's happened before. I went through something similar when the church was going through its crisis in 1995, 96, 1997, 98, 99. It kind of, that's when I grew physically considerably, because I kind of ate my way through that one, I think, more than anything. Probably because I was afraid that everything would fall apart and I would never eat again. So psychologically, I was trying to make up for what might come, okay? Again, quoting from the book, I don't want to talk about it, Terence Real, the author, says, "Men tend to manifest depression differently than women. Few things about men and women seem more dissimilar than the way we tend to handle our feelings." That's true. That's one of the biggest differences between men and women, the way we handle our feelings. Why should depression, which is a disorder of feeling, be handled in the same way by both sexes when most other emotional issues are not? Good point. So, again, the title of my sermon is I Don't Want to Talk About It. I've got another book which is also on depression, On the Edge of Darkness by Kathy Cronkite. And this is stories from some of America's most famous people who all went through depression and some of their memories and how they dealt with it. It's quite a useful little book. In chapter 3, the question is asked, what is depression? My boyfriend's out of town. I'm so depressed. I hate rain. It's depressing. I don't want to go out tonight. I'm too depressed over my haircut. Call me tomorrow. One of the great misunderstandings people have about clinical or medical depression stems from the colloquial use of the word to mean less than happy. Everyone has felt pain. Everyone has felt grief. Those are part of the human experience. Fortunately, not everyone knows the depth of anguish that takes over your life when depression rules. According to the Random House Dictionary, the fourth definition of depression is emotional dejection greater than that warranted by any objective reason, which of course makes it difficult for other people to understand why somebody can be depressed. Emotional dejection greater than that warranted by any objective reason. So to anybody else, it would seem as if, well, why are you depressed? I mean, for example, if somebody talks to me about a broken relationship, instinctively I think, well, what's the problem? There's plenty of other girls out there, But that, of course, does not help. And to say that would be the most stupid thing, the most insensitive thing you can say. But, I think it, to an outsider, it would seem sometimes that there's no logic. But clearly there isn't, by that definition from the Random House Dictionary. I looked up the Oxford Dictionary to get their definition of depression. And the first two things were, one, severe unhappiness and dejection. Two, a medical condition in which a person experiences severe feelings of hopelessness and inadequacy. Let me go back to the book here, On the Edge of Darkness, because there's another page I wanted to read a little bit from here. After a loss or a major disappointment, explains Frederick Goodwin, an MD, director of the National Institute of Mental Health, and an authority on depression and manic depressive illness. After a loss, it's normal to feel sad, tearful, to lose interest in things, to see the glass as half empty, to question your ability to do anything well. A parent after the first confrontation with a teenage child, a writer who can't come up with a story, a student who receives a failing grade, may all experience difficulty sleeping or a change in appetite. The difference between that and clinical depression rests on three questions. How many symptoms have been experienced? For example, tingling in the limbs, heaviness in the chest, serious inability to fall asleep or to stay asleep, appetite changes that result in weight loss or gain. And then the question, how long have the symptoms last, and so on. But the third question he asks is, how much do these feelings interfere with your normal functioning? Can you still care for your children, engage in social interaction, hold a job? Some people stumble on through life but with no real joy. Some, while suffering serious depressive symptoms, fulfill only the day's most urgent requirements. A journalist who can't complete basic hygiene functions but appears each morning at the newspaper. A mother who can't conduct a simple social exchange but keeps her children fed and clothed. Others are incapacitated. So those are some of the symptoms of depression. Some of the most famous people and some of the greatest people who have ever lived struggled with depression. So Winston Churchill, for example, struggled with what he called, in his diaries, his black dog. You know, he would write to his wife and say, you know, the black dog is bothering me again, which was a euphemism for depression. In 1915, following a particularly serious defeat in World War I, for which he was blamed, his wife wrote that he was filled with such a black depression that I felt he would never recover. This is the chapter of one of the books. The chapter is The Dog and I, The Black Dog. Thoreau once observed, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in this, written in the 19th century, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Just think about that. The mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. Men generally are considered the main breadwinner, the head of the family, ultimately responsible for providing for the physical needs of those who are dependent on them. The modern male also has to be involved with his children. In the church, there's added responsibilities, maintaining a close relationship with God, helping others, responsibilities at church itself, keeping the Sabbath and the holy days, giving sermons, and so on. These should help us have the right focus, but they can also be very stressful, and that also can contribute to depression. Let's look at some biblical examples of depression, because it's amazing how many people in the Bible, you know, were depressed at different times, based on this definition of depression. If you look at Numbers chapter 11, we can begin by reading about Moses. There's more examples than what I'm giving here. If you look up the word depression in my Bible, I didn't find it in the dictionary at the back, but despondency was there. And failure was another word, but despondency was the word where I finally found this particular subject covered. But in Numbers chapter 11 and verse 15, it says, if you treat me like this, please kill me here and now, if I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness. So, you know, Moses got so depressed, he wanted to die. You know, kill me right now. Kill me here and now. I just want to die. You know, I think a lot of people have had feelings like that at different times. I just want to die. You get overwhelmed by everything. There's, you know, so many problems, and it seems like there's no answer sometimes. Everything is so difficult that you just want to die. And Moses felt that way. Jeremiah chapter 45. Look at the example of Jeremiah, who, of course, had a very depressing job. Moses had a depressing job. You know, having to lead all these grumbling, groaning, complaining Israelites for 40 years in the desert. Be bad enough in the desert by yourself, but with 3 to 6 million people along with you, all complaining, except for Joshua and Caleb, you know, it must have been very difficult. And, you know, I think of all the other problems they had, you know. Jeremiah chapter 45 and verse 3, Jeremiah had the responsibility of preaching to Judah about its fall, you know, which is not very popular. You know, writing articles about what's coming upon the U.S. and Britain is not very popular either. Verse 3, you said, woe is me now, for the Lord has added grief to my sorrow. I fainted in my sighing, and I find no rest. So Jeremiah even says, you know, God has added this grief to my sorrow, because God wanted him to do this job. And the job was just so difficult sometimes, so overwhelming, so depressing, that he struggled with this problem of depression or despondency. David, of course, is a very good example. I've always thought, you may disagree, but I've always thought that David was what we would call today bipolar, manic depressive, because, you know, David sometimes would, be on a high, so to speak, but then at other times be in the real depths of despair. You see that in his life. In Psalm 6 and verse 6, here's David during his sickness. I am weary with my groaning, he says. All night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with my tears. So David was sick, and he was getting depressed, very depressed. I am weary with my groaning. I'm just worn out from, the pain and this overwhelming feeling of despondency. I'm weary with my groaning. All night I make my bed swim. Now, that could have a dual meaning. On the one hand, he could have been really sick. I mean, for example, when I get malaria, I sweat so bad that, everything just is soaked. So if I'm lying in bed, it just soaks through everything. In Ghana, we'd have to get rid of mattresses. That's how bad it was when you had malaria. And I don't know what he had, but if he had a fever, that might have been a factor. But it might tie in with what he's saying in the final point, I drench my couch with my tears. So he was so despondent, he would just cry. He was a very emotional person, David. And you see that in his life. But he was clearly fighting some serious problems in this particular area. And it seems like it went on for a long time. Of course, one of his problems was in the area of relationships. David had some serious relationship problems. Psalm 38, verse 17, where David writes this, for I am ready to fall, and my sorrow is continually before me. So he felt like he was, ready to just fall, like the end of everything. Like he couldn't keep his act together, I think, is the term we would use today. For I am ready to fall, and my sorrow is continually before me. He just could not get away from the pain that he was feeling, from the hurt that he was feeling. He could not get away from it, no matter what he did. And of course, sometimes people do have problems like that, that no matter what they do, they just cannot deal with the problem. So what do you do when when there's a problem that you just cannot deal with, for which there is no solution? Psalm 42 and verse 11. Look at that one. Psalm 42 and verse 11. Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him, the help of my countenance and my God. So, David realized that his hope lay in God, but that didn't mean that automatically the problem was resolved and everything was fine. Go back to Psalm 31 for a moment. Psalm 31 and verse 10. For my life is spent with grief, and my years with sighing. Again, it brings to mind what Thoreau said, that most men live lives of quiet desperation. You can see that here in Psalm 31, verse 10. For my life is spent with grief, and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. So, my strength fails because of my sin, because of my faults, because of my trespasses, because of these things that afflict me, whatever they were at this particular point in David's life, and my bones waste away. Depression gets right down to the bones. It's like everything aches because the tension is so great, and it's so debilitating. So you don't feel like doing anything. And, it's difficult sometimes, like with me over the last 4 weeks, I couldn't tell whether it was the physical pain from the kidney stones that was causing that, or whether it was the depression that was affecting the physical pain and making it worse. And, you know, you've got to work on all these things at the same time. Job chapter 3. Job was another guy who got rather depressed. Job chapter 3. In fact, you know, it's kind of interesting. I haven't gone through the whole Bible to try and, you know, do a tally here. But it'd be interesting to see exactly how many of the great men of the Bible were depressed and how many weren't. Then, you know, I would think that, you know, most struggled with depression of one sort or another at different times. You know, and it is a natural human condition at different times in a person's life. Look at this, Job 3. You can't get much more depressed than this. In verse 3, may the day perish on which I was born. You know, I wish I'd never been born, is what he's saying. And the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived. So, you know, when his mom gave birth and there was this great celebration because a boy had been born, he said, I wish that day had never happened. I wish I was dead. I wish I had never lived, is what Job was saying here at this particular point. Verse 11. Why did I not die at birth? It would have been better to have died at birth. Why did I not perish when I came from the womb? See the thinking? And I think most people have had thoughts like this at different points in their lives. Maybe if you're still on the young side of life, maybe those feelings will come at some point later on. But, you know, we all have difficulties and challenges and problems. And, you know, then we can get depressed as a result of those things. Chapter 10 of Job as well. Chapter 10 here of Job. Another scripture. My soul loathes my life. You know, I loathe my life. This is self-loathing here. I loathe my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. So my soul loathes my life. I hate myself, basically, is what he's saying here. And, you know, I'm going to say what I think. Because there was an anger there. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. See, he was bitter about things. Now, you know, he'd just been put through a great deal. You know, God, remember, gave Satan free rein on Job. He could do anything to him that he wanted to except kill him. And so Job had a lot of setbacks. So, you know, there was a lot of anger and bitterness which was building up. And, you know, I think a lot of people, when they, you know, have personal trials, can often feel that way. And there's an anger even towards God. My soul loathes my life. You know, I just hate my life. I will give free course to my plaint. I'm going to speak my mind. I'm going to say what I want to say. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. Look at chapter 17 of Job. Chapter 17 of Job. And verse 15. Where then is my hope? As for my hope, who can see it? So Job at least asked the question, where then is my hope? And as for my hope, who can see it? So, you know, he's starting to look for hope. So let's look at some ways in which we can cope with depression. Now, first of all, I want to mention here that clinical depression may require medication. Clinical depression is a depression that just goes on and on and on and on. You can have a severe depression for a couple of weeks, even a month, but if that depression goes on and on and on, then it may require medication. However, I want to say this as a cautionary note, coming off the medication can result in even more severe depression and even thoughts of suicide. So it's best to read up on medications before taking them, to look at the possible side effects and talk to others. If you know of other people who've had certain medications, for example, I mean, I know somebody who, you know, came off Zoloft and, you know, was even more depressed after coming off it or trying to come off it than they had been before taking it. So keep that in mind. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm not giving advice on this, but just be careful. That's all I'm saying. And just look into it yourself before making a decision. But when it comes to coping with depression, I got to say there's one contributory factor in my case, which I put top of the list here. because I have a problem with that, and that is learn to relax. I don't relax very well. Tension is a contributor to depression. I've got another book here. There's a lot of books here. Managing Your Mind, the Mental Fitness Guide. I picked this up a while ago. Discounted book, but it's quite a good book. Chapter 11 is on learning how to relax. Learning how to relax. Well, before I read that, let me read what I've got in my notes here. You should learn to relax because tension, this is a quote from the book, you should learn to relax because tension, the opposite of relaxation, has so many painful effects. It produces aches and pains, perhaps most commonly in the neck and back. Having aches and pains adds to your troubles and gives you something extra to worry about. Learning how to relax is not one thing, it is many. It is an attitude. Taking things calmly and in your stride, or keeping cool, it is a physical skill. Learning how to recognize and release tension, both physical and mental, it is a habit. Developing routines that work for you rather than against you. It is a restorative, a way of giving yourself rest and recreation and refilling the systems that are otherwise constantly depleted. That's pages 104 and 105 if you want to get the book yourself and look at it. Look at Isaiah chapter 35. Isaiah chapter 35. And verse 3. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Now here is a scripture that helps us to understand that we need to look to God for help in this particular respect in coming out of depression. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 5. Timothy was giving advice to, Paul was giving advice to Timothy here. In verse 23 it says, no longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. It says a little wine, by the way, but again, the point is, you know, we need to relax, you know, and a glass of wine can be very helpful. And, you know, obviously Timothy got a bit stressed out and had some personal problems there too, maybe, along the way. So did the Apostle Paul. So Paul, the older man, was giving advice there. In Mark, we learn something too from Jesus Christ. In Mark chapter 6, we learn the need for time to ourselves, which is very important. Verses 45 and 46. Immediately he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethesda, while he sent the multitude away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. You know, we need time to ourselves. We need time to pray. We need time to study God's word. If we don't, our spiritual tank is going to be empty. And that will then add to the depression. Now, you know, depression may come anyway, but, you know, if our spiritual tank is empty, it's much more difficult to deal with. So we have to try and get into a routine that works for us where we can have that time with God. I'll come back to that in a few moments. But when it comes to relaxation, there are some things which are beneficial and some things which aren't. For example, one of the things that I try and do, I don't succeed every day, but Palace and I, as many mornings as possible, will take the dog for a walk in the woods. And, you know, we like it there. There's absolutely nobody else there, which is why I'm not telling you where we go, because I don't want anybody else there, okay? It's just the two of us plus the dog. And, you know, we walk for a couple of miles, at least 2 miles, maybe a bit longer. And the good thing is not just the walking. The walking is very beneficial. It is one of the things that's recommended in dealing with depression. But just getting back to nature is beneficial. When we're out in these woods, these undisclosed woods, You don't realize that there's a city nearby. And, you really are in God's creation, and it's just beautiful. And it gives great peace of mind and helps us relax. And like I said, walking is recommended for those suffering from depression, as is relaxation in general. You know, it's kind of interesting. We in the West suffer from these things more than people do in African countries, for example. And I think one reason is because we don't really walk anywhere nowadays, you know. And most Africans do. And their health is better as a result of that, unless they get something like malaria or something. But, you know, their health is generally better than ours is because they're living more naturally in that way. And, you know, they go through the bush and it's all nice and peaceful and quiet. And, you know, we need a bit more of that, too, in our lives. And, you know, we need to get out and just get back to nature as much as possible. So that's one thing that's beneficial. In reading up on this, by the way, it's interesting, too, how some things benefit and some things don't. For example, listening to certain kinds of music help people relax and lower their level of depression. Classical music was mentioned. Soothing music of different kinds can help. Loud, raucous music doesn't. Rock music, rap music actually makes the problem worse, not better. Television makes the problem worse, and that has something to do with the flickering image on the screen and something it does to the mind. So it makes things worse. I'm sure if they did a study, television at election time is even worse when it comes to causing depression. So, you know, you have to factor that in as well. So, you know, some things just help and some things don't, and sometimes you have to experiment a bit. So relaxation is extremely important, and as Jesus Christ showed here, there's the need included in that relaxation just to be by yourself a little bit and just have that time to yourself. Secondly, close relationships are important in dealing with depression. Proverbs 12 and verse 25. Proverbs 12 and verse 25. Anxiety in the heart of man causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. So, you know, anxiety, worry is anxiety, causes depression, but a good word makes it glad. So if you've got a friend who says the right thing, then that can make a big difference to helping you with coping with, you know, feelings of depression. Some people, the right people, can have a positive effect. Family, of course, is extremely important in this regard. It's difficult to be depressed when the grandchildren come over. However, last Sunday when they came over, I was. I got back Sunday afternoon around 4 o'clock, and I'd had a 6-day trip. I started in Lansing, drove to the home office on the Tuesday. Wednesday, Thursday, had all-day meetings at the Senior Pastors Conference on Africa. Went extremely well, by the way, but, you know, that's not the point. It's still very tiring. Then on the Friday, I had to drive from the home office to Beloit, and I had a problem with the car, which kind of stressed me out a bit for about 3 hours till AAA came and I got it resolved. And then in Beloit, on the Sabbath, we had the World News and Prophecy Seminar, which is very demanding. You know, you speak twice, but you've got everybody coming up asking questions and so on. There's new people there. Then on the Sunday, I had to drive back from Beloit through Chicago. And if there's any place I hate driving through, it is Chicago. I was actually tempted to go through the UP, but I figured it might take 3 days. But anything to get away from driving through Chicago. But anyway, I got back at about 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon to be greeted by Alyssa, because Alex had driven up that day, and also, you know, Kurt's oldest, Paris, and of course they want to play immediately. Grandpa, you know, ugh, you know. And, you know, I was, you know, I was nice, I think, and, you know, I was trying to be normal, but it was just too much for me. It really was too much for me. And, you know, I just realized that, and I felt I'm missing this, you know, good time with my grandchildren because I'm just exhausted. And, you know, I was just feeling down about everything and still had those physical problems and so on. So, you know, but normally family, of course, is very beneficial, and getting together with the family is great. And grandchildren really help greatly. So if you don't have any, you need to talk to your kids about it and get them moving in that direction. Friends are also important. Remember, males suffer from this more than females, and also with men, depression is different. Therefore, a man needs to talk to another man or men just to compare experiences here. There's the problem. As the title of the book says, I keep holding this up so you get it. I don't want to talk about it. See? That is the general approach that men have. I don't want to talk about it. Okay? And it's a perfect title for a book. Now, I don't agree with everything in here, by the way, because he said some things that I wouldn't agree with. But a lot of it does help you understand a lot about male depression. It's good reading. It's easy to read. It's not depressing to read, whereas that one can be a bit depressing. But anyway, I don't want to talk about it, okay? But, guys do need to talk about it. And, just compare notes, because, I've noticed this week I talked to one or two others in the congregation who struggled with the same thing. And, just sharing is beneficial. You realize that, you're not the only one that's been going through this. Others go through it too. And I think wives need to encourage their husbands to go talk about it with other men, because, as these books show, it is somewhat different for the ladies. Proverbs 27, verse 17. Proverbs 27 and verse 17. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. So iron sharpens iron in many ways. And even sharing thoughts on studies of the Bible can, make us sharper. But applying it to this context of depression and overcoming depression, as iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. The Oxford Dictionary defines countenance as a person's face or facial expression. In other words, a friend can lift the mood, can help you change your mood. And I think, again, it just emphasizes the importance of friendship. But in order to have a good friendship like that, you've got to be willing to share some of these problems and that you might have that might be contributing to the depression. Proverbs 20 and verse 5. Proverbs 20 verse 5. Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. This is really advice to those friends. Remember Job's friends? I mean, Job was depressed. His friends came around and made him even more depressed. We don't want to do that. Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water. In other words, getting somebody to talk and explain what's really troubling them is very difficult. It's like, trying to do something in deep water. You've got to kind of dig deep, so to speak. Well, you wouldn't dig deep in water, but you know what I mean. It's that principle there. You've got to delve deep to try to find out what is really the problem. And, that means learning how to ask the right questions. And showing, too, you're not judgmental. You're not going to be shocked at anything that is said or repulsed by it, but in trying to help the person, because you really don't know what it is that's contributing to the depression. So a man of understanding will draw it out. Somebody who understands these kind of problems. One thing I might mention here, and of course this is going out on tape, so I'm on record after this. It goes out on our website tonight, unless the baby comes, and then it'll be delayed a while, won't it? But one thing I might mention, I work with the Focused Education Committee. My responsibility is Anchor, but one thing that we're looking at is broadening the scope of Anchor to include lots of other problems. For example, eating disorders and depression, addictions of various kinds, alcoholism, and so on. And we're looking into that. And last week in Beloit, it was amazing the number of people that came up and started sharing some of these things with me. And, some of them are even, a couple of them anyway, go around lecturing on different problems. One young lady I met goes and gives talks on eating disorders, which are a major problem. I had a congregation once with 6 people in it that had eating disorders, just in the one congregation, which is amazing. in a small group of people. But, you know, these are major problems. And they all have common roots. All of these problems do. And, you know, we need to understand them more and help people, you know, to deal with them. And yet we've had a problem in the church, and I think most churches have this problem. And, you know, I think it is this, that, you know, we don't tend to share our problems because, you know, we learned in the beginning. I mean, I learned right at the beginning, 40 years ago when I first started coming into the church. You know, I called up after reading the literature, I wanted to come to church. Well, you can't come to church. Well, why can't I come to church? And basically what they said was, you can't come until you're perfect. You know, until you keep the Sabbath and the holy days, until, you know, you quit this and quit that, then we'll let you come to church. They even told me to get my hair cut, you know, before I could come to church. You know, so of course, this subliminally is telling us all, and told most of us in this room when we first came into the church, it told us all, you've got to be perfect before you can come to church. Now, it's not the same today, you know. We don't have that kind of approach anymore, and I think that's a very good thing. But having said that, I think a lot of us were affected by this. And so, you know, we try to put this image on of perfection, like, you know, we're perfect. We don't have any problems, of course. Now, of course, some of us are closer to perfection than others, but, you know, I'm just kidding when I said that. But, you know, I think, you know, this is something we need to overcome. If I can just digress for a moment to James 5, verse 16. We were talking about this a little earlier in the young adult speech group. But James 5, verse 16, for example, I've often thought about this, and I wondered how we can ever get to this point. It says, confess your trespasses to one another. Confess your faults, your sins. The Greek word is paratoma, and it means iniquities, sins. Confess your problems, whatever you want to call them, to one another, and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. And we've not had that environment in the church in the past. And maybe we never will, but, you know, at least we can start moving in the right direction and start sharing things that may be helpful to each of us. So Proverbs 20, verse 5, counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out. You know, when we're trying to help people with a problem like depression, we need to ask the right questions to try to help the person share whatever are the contributory factors to the depression. That means, of course, you know, ensuring confidentiality, because if somebody, you know, is talking about their depression, they don't want you to get up in church next week and discuss it all in a sermonette, you know. So, again, close relationships are important in dealing with depression. I want to add under this, this is point number two, B, some relationships can cause depression, okay? Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 12. You know, I think back to some of those people that took their own lives or tried to take their own lives, and it helps you to see just how some relationships can cause depression. Proverbs 13 and verse 12. Hope deferred makes the heart sick. But when the desire comes, it is a tree of life. So the first part, hope deferred makes the heart sick. In other words, you know, a young guy, you know, likes a girl, and, you know, the relationship goes on for a while, and then, you know, he's hoping for a permanent relationship, but then she, you know, turns him down and goes off with somebody else. Well, you know, hope deferred makes the heart sick. I mean, that triggers off depression. I mean, some of you guys have gone through that. I know that because you shared it with me. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing when a relationship doesn't work out. I might add here, as I've often said in private counseling, the more physical the relationship was, the more difficult it is when it's broken off. And this is why, I'm sure this is one reason why, you know, God's laws say what they say. You know, we shouldn't get into you know, physical things, fornication specifically, because, you know, it will cause serious emotional damage, as well as possibly causing physical damage too. So, but if you're involved with somebody and the relationship is not going anywhere, break it off. In the book Managing Your Mind, on page 123, the writer says, suppressing our own desires for too long will lead to an explosion. It's a good point. Suppressing our own desires for too long will lead to an explosion. Point number three. Your relationship with God is of vital importance at such a time. And by the way, I'm only giving you 3 points. You know, there's so many different aspects of depression we could look at, but just go away with those 3. Relax. And then the importance of relationships, you know, with others, particularly with family. Thirdly, your relationship with God is of vital importance at such a time. Depression does not mean there is something wrong, you know, with that relationship. I think this is a reason why a lot of guys in the church would not share the fact that they're depressed, simply because I think the fear would be that people will think, I'm not close enough to God, that there's something spiritually wrong. You know, but it's nothing to do with that. You know, depression is due to many factors. Having a good relationship with God helps you to start and put it right, but it doesn't guarantee it's going to be put right. There's a lot more to it than that, and, you know, you really need to read more to understand that. But, you know, everybody suffers from depression at different times. You know, you can be, you know, the greatest, most loyal member of the church and have a close relationship with God. But if a close family member dies, like your mom died, you know, Ron and Floyd, mom has died, you know, inevitably there's going to be a period of depression afterwards. You know, I went through that when my parents died. And, you know, tied in with that was an upheaval in the church here in Lansing that we had, right in the middle between both parents dying. And, you know, all of this just, you know, added up and you just crash. It doesn't matter how close you are to God, it's still going to happen because it's just too much for the system, too much for the mind to handle, too much for the body to handle. So everybody suffers from depression at different times. And as we've seen, some of the greatest men of the Bible struggled with it. However, God can be a great help in dealing with depression. Look at Isaiah chapter 41. Isaiah chapter 41 and verse 13. Isaiah 41 and verse 13. For I, the Lord your God, will hold your right hand, saying to you, fear not, I will help you. You know, God says, I will hold your right hand, which is your, you know, primary hand. In fact, you know, you see that, like with the grandkids, you know, they hold up their right hand to hold your hand when you're walking. And, you know, I did this with Alyssa on Wednesday just before Alex left. I took Alex and her down to Bina's for a coffee. Not for the baby. The coffee was, you know, baby wanted a cookie. Boy, do you know how much the cookies cost there? Wow. Oh, you know, if any of you can help bail me out, I would appreciate it. But I couldn't believe it. Just a cookie for the baby. Wow. Anyway, I decided to walk her back. She wanted to walk. She needed some exercise, and Alex was tired, and she was about to drive home. So I took Alyssa, and she holds up her right hand. And, you know, I walk her for a block. We're 4 blocks away. Okay. She held up her right hand. I walk her for a block, and then she wanted to be picked up. Okay. So I picked her up and walked her for another block, and then I was exhausted, so I put her down again. She holds up her hand again. I walk her for another block, and then she's too exhausted, so I pick her up for the 4th block, and I thought, you know, I'm not thinking I'm going to volunteer to do this again. So anyway, I finally did get her home. You know, it just illustrates the point here. So, you know, what God is saying here is, I will hold your right hand, just like, you know, a father holds his child's hand. And, you know, she felt confident because I was holding her hand. And that's the thing. She had absolute confidence in me. I mean, her mom wasn't there. She didn't cry. She just had absolute confidence in me as I walked her home. And, you know, that's the kind of confidence that we can have in God, too. And that's the point of that particular passage here. Now, guilt can be a big contributory factor to depression. You know, feelings of failure, like I'm not good enough. And again, this is more of a male problem, and it's difficult, actually. All these books bring out it's difficult for wives to help their husbands with depression because it is so different between male and female. Just like, you know, it's very difficult for men to really understand childbirth, you know. When I was in the hospital in Hawaii 4 weeks ago today, and it turned out to be kidney stones, you know, the doctor was trying to explain what it would be like, and he said it's just like, he said it's the male equivalent of giving birth to a baby. And, you know, I made some flippant comment, like, well, that looks easy to me, you know, but upset my wife. No, I would never say a thing like that. But, you know, he was trying to explain to me what it would be like. Well, I do know what it was like because I was present at the births of each of our children. And, you know, it's not easy. And it gave me an idea as to what was to come. Then he also added, he said, it's a little bit like passing a razor blade, is what he said. So that was like, yeah, wow. Anyway, I'm glad to say it's over with. Matthew 9 and verse 2. How did I get onto that? What was I talking about? Well, I don't know what I was saying, but anyway, let's have a look here. We're back to guilt here, okay? Matthew 9, verse 2. You do realize this is going to happen more and more from now on, you know, that I'm going to forget where I am and what I'm saying, you know? I'll end up more and more like Richard Dalton. Anyway, verse 2. Then behold, they brought to him a paralytic lying on a bed. When Jesus saw their faith, he said, "Son, be of good cheer. Your sins are forgiven you." Now, you know, this was a physical problem this guy had. But the principle is the same with our spiritual problems. Whatever sins we've committed, whatever guilt we have, your sins are forgiven you. And I think sometimes we don't really understand that fully. We still have feelings of guilt and shame, which can add to depression, feelings of failure, feelings of inadequacy, all those things can add to failure. So, you know, we need to understand this subject of guilt and of forgiveness and of grace better. And, you know, those are good Bible studies. It's hard, though, when you're depressed to actually get into the Bible in any deep way. It's hard to really focus on anything. That's part of the problem with depression. There's no ability to really focus on anything. And, you know, it was only yesterday, really, that all my physical problems lifted. And then I felt great again, and I got a lot done yesterday. But really, for about a month, I just kind of struggled through every day trying to get things done. You know, our children can make us feel guilty. I know that's been a problem in my life. You know, when our children, as they get older, disappoint us, there's a natural tendency to think back to where we went wrong. So we ask ourselves, where did we go wrong? What did we do wrong? Why is she doing this? Why is he doing that? And, you know, eventually you have to come to the point where you just have to let go. You really have to let go. There's nothing you can do about it. When your kids are 18, they're legally responsible. If they get up to something, it's their problem. You might be able to help them, give advice if they come back to you, but there's nothing you can do about it. Kurt called me on Sunday, and it was tragic what he was telling me. He was telling me about his neighbor. His neighbor had just come over, and I think his neighbor's late 30s, and she's got lung cancer, and she's had it for a couple of years, so, you know, she's going to be gone in a few weeks, really. She knows that. And she has one child, a daughter, who I think is 16 or 17, and she has a live-in boyfriend, but the daughter's father is no longer involved in the daughter's life. So she is, in effect, leaving her daughter behind with nobody. Okay? So, of course, this has troubled the mom. But making things worse is the daughter's going through a very difficult period, rebelling against her mother, causing her mother just so much pain, committing every kind of antisocial behavior imaginable. You know, when Kurt was talking to me, I said, well, I can see the problem here. The problem is the girl is angry because her mom is dying. Because the only security she's got in her life is her mother. And, you know, if her mo- when not if, but when her mother dies, she's got nobody. And this is why the girl is so angry, and she's taking it out on her mother, because at 16 or 17, you know, she can't reason it through and realize, as all of us who are older do, these things happen. You know, death is a part of life. It is appointed unto all men once to die. Everybody's going to die. And, you know, even in life we have problems and difficulties and trials, and these things just happen. And, you know, we can process that because we've seen it happen so many times before. But somebody who's that young, 16 or 17, can't process that. And she needs help. And apparently she's not getting the help that she needs, which is very sad. But, you know, in a few weeks' time at the most, she's going to be on her own. I want to read to you again from Managing Your Mind. There's a passage or chapter, work on changing yourself, not on changing others. The temptation, particularly if a relationship is stormy, is to insist to yourself and to others that it's not you that needs to change, but the other person. Now, it may well be true that the other person should change. But since you can't change other people, it's not worth trying. Do not be distracted by trying to change others. Change yourself and change the way you relate to others. The changes you make will precipitate changes in others. Leave these changes up to them, and the relationship will feel better to you both. And this certainly applies with children, but it applies, you know, with other relationships too. That if you can't change something in somebody, then, well, you can't. You just can't. So make the changes you can make in your life, and then hope that the other person may be inspired by that and make some changes in their life too. Look at 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 1. So work on changing yourself, not on changing others. And I think a good thing to do is to, you know, pray, fast, meditate, and write down some goals for a year, which might help deal with some of these things. Because what you're really trying to do is you're trying to adopt preventative measures that may stave off future depression. While you're depressed, it's very difficult to get out of it, but at some point it will lift. And then when it lifts, that's when you've got an opportunity to try and get on top of things so that you can try and avoid the same problem later on. But then, of course, later on, some other thing may happen that will bring it back. But, you know, at least you may have your spiritual tank maybe full enough to be able to cope with it better. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 3 to 7. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So, you know, Peter here mentions the hope that we have, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled, and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. Now verse 6 is the important verse here. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials. You know, that this Peter here is pointing out to the whole church. This was a general epistle. It wasn't just to a few people. It wasn't to one city. He's pointing out to everybody, look, we've got to expect trials in this life. We will have trials. It's one thing that's guaranteed. And, you know, everybody does, of course, not just Christians. But, you know, we are going to have trials, so, you know, we should expect them. That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it's tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So, you know, part of this is the testing, by fire, you know, is strengthening us. It actually makes us stronger people. And, of course, enables us to help others in the world tomorrow. I had a call just a few days ago from a friend of mine who's younger than me, and he's got terminal cancer. He's been a church member, I think, all his life. I think he was brought up in the church. And he was the one who first asked me to help out as a pastor with Anchor, because he struggles with the problem of same-sex attraction. And he's a member of the church. He's, you know, a married man with children. And he's had terminal cancer now for a few months. And he knows he doesn't have long to live. And he said to me, he said, Melvin, he said, I've got to tell you, he said, cancer is nothing compared to same-sex attraction, SSA, as he calls it. Which kind of hit me when he said that. I thought, wow, that's really saying something. It helps you understand the difficulties that some people have. And the same with problems like eating disorders and alcoholism. I've got a good friend who's a recovering alcoholic. And he's now gone, I think it's 3 or maybe 4 years now, without alcohol. He can never, ever touch alcohol at all, because if he does, it'll set him off again, and it may take him years to get on top of things again and begin his life again. And you know, the pain of something like that, you know, there's a lot more to it than just alcohol. I mean, I could give up alcohol, wouldn't bother me at all. You know, it really would not, because I'm not that bothered about it one way or the other. But you know, I don't have an addiction problem with alcohol, whereas he does. And he's given it up, but you know, the brain is still is still craving it, and so he goes through cycles of depression and you know, relationship problems and so on, which all come back to his alcoholism. But he has to contend with this every day of his life, just as other people do with their problems, eating disorders, for example. I find it hard to understand anorexia. Remember, Dave Logan got me that T-shirt, you know. XXXL was the only size it came in, and written right across it were the words, I beat anorexia, you know, and I've worn it on occasion, and it's always good for a laugh. People come up and say, well, tell me, how did you overcome anorexia? I say, well, it was a long struggle, but I say, finally, I figured it out. I said, the key is, once you start eating, you don't stop, because if you stop, there's always a possibility of a relapse. So that explains why I'm always eating, you see. And a lot of people look at me and think, that sounds, makes sense, yeah, makes sense. Better hurry, it's time to eat. Anyway, so it's hard for me to understand anorexia, but people have that problem. And, you know, it's interesting talking to people who have eating disorders, because, you know, you see, I mean, there's similarities between all these different problems, whether it be alcoholism or sexual addictions or eating disorders or whatever. There are similarities and, you know, certain commonalities. But, you know, somebody can weigh as little as 85 pounds and think that they're fat. You know, and we're talking here about an adult, weigh 85 pounds and think that they're fat. And that they're eating too much. And, you know, I can now look for the signs. So if any of you have a problem here, I do notice the signs now, because I've seen it with, you know, working with young people and taking young people on trips and so on. You know, there are certain ways in which people hide their eating disorders. And, you know, they're doing it subliminally, maybe not realizing that they're actually doing it. But it's a serious problem. Anyway, last week in Beloit, I talked with a number of people who were struggling with serious issues in their lives, eating disorders, alcoholism, and other addictions. And all of them really are encouraged by the fact that they will be able to help others with similar problems in the kingdom of God. You know, which I think is very encouraging. Another book, it's an encouraging way to look at it. Another book, which is very helpful, is one that was given to me by somebody, The Good Life by Charles Colson. This was a book, and I want to close on this book. Charles Colson spent a few years in prison for his involvement in the Watergate scandal and subsequent cover-up. I don't think he actually had anything to do with Watergate itself, but he was involved in the cover-up, which, you know, eventually brought down the Nixon presidency. His fear in prison was that his life was over and he would never amount to anything again. But when he came out of prison, he dedicated himself to an international prison ministry and has been able to serve thousands of others as a result of that. And, you know, one of the points he brings out here, and it's brought out in one of the other books too, is that one of the most helpful ways to overcome depression is to find something that you care so passionately about that you can dedicate the rest of your life to it. Which is why, in middle age, depression can have a very beneficial effect, because it makes you focus on what is most important, And then you spend the last 10, 15, 20 years of your life focusing primarily on that, whatever it might be. And, you know, that helps you. It's a kind of a sense of purpose that comes, you know, following depression. Chapter 3 of his book is titled The Great Paradoxes. Reading this chapter in particular is helpful in dealing with depression. So I'll close on looking at these four paradoxes. Number one, out of suffering and defeat often comes victory. Very interesting, and it's true. He gives the example of Fyodor Dostoevsky, who was a Russian writer in the 19th century. I read a couple of his books many, many years ago. Crime and Punishment is his most famous book, which is an excellent book on just guilt and you know, the crime and then the punishment. The punishment the person goes through himself before, not institutionally, but himself because of the crime that he's committed. But Dostoevsky, the story is in the book, which book is it in? So much here anyway. Forgotten which book it was in. It was in one of these books. Oh, no, it was in Colson's book. He gives the story of Fyodor Dostoevsky, who was sent to Siberia because he had made some political comments, so he was being punished, and he was sent to Siberia for 8 years. Then his sentence was changed, and he was sentenced to a firing squad. And he was actually brought out, blindfolded, and stood in line with all the others. And just before they shot him, he got reprieved. And so he had a whole life to look forward to beyond that. And he said, he wrote this to his brother. He was released eventually. When I look back on my past and think how much time I wasted on nothing, how much time has been lost in futilities, errors, laziness, incapacity to live, my heart bleeds. Life is a gift. Now, in changing my life, I am reborn in a new form. I swear that I will not lose hope and will keep my soul and heart pure. I will be reborn for the better. That's all my hope, all my consolation. And then he dedicated himself as a great social reformer and also somewhat of a revolutionary in Russia. But, you know, he had this passion in the rest of his life. And, you know, when you face death, it really does change your thinking and changes your focus. And, you know, you are able to put aside all those things that are not so important. So out of suffering and defeat often comes victory. And out of depression can come victory too. As we try to refocus and try to, you know, establish our goals and prioritize for the rest of our lives. Paradox number two. We have to lose our lives to save them. Losing our lives means getting ourselves out of the way. Carlson writes, the good life isn't about finding ourselves. It's about losing ourselves. Once self is subordinated, we can discover a new identity with others and a new understanding of who we really are. You know, and again, it's a good point. You know, we tend to focus very much on our problems and difficulties and challenges, but, you know, we have to get rid of all of that if we're going to really amount to anything in life. It doesn't mean we have to ignore those things. They still have to be dealt with, but, you know, we have to subordinate the self in order to focus on, you know, how we're going to lose our, you know, how we're going to, what our legacy is going to be. That's the way to put it, really. What legacy we're going to leave behind when we're no longer around. And I think that's a very good point. Paradox number three. Freedom lies not in conforming to the world's expectations or even realizing what we take to be our deepest wishes. It lies in following the call in our lives. See, when Carlson went to prison, he thought his career was finished. He would never, ever become a rich man like he had been before. He was earning six figures in the 1960s. I mean, six figures are good now, but in the 60s they were even better, you know. And he just said, you know, his desire was to make himself rich. But in prison he realized that would never happen. But he learned to follow the calling in his life, which was to establish this prison ministry, an international prison ministry, which has helped thousands of people around the world. Each of us, he says, and I think this is important, Each of us is called to some work. And our ultimate joy and fulfillment, yes, freedom, will come in our obedience to that mission. So this is what we need to focus on, and to help us get us out of depression. Each of us is called to some work, some purpose. And it'll be different for everybody. Each person has to figure it out themselves. But, you know, what is it that I could do with the rest of my life that would be of significance? That I feel passionately about? What do I feel passionately about that I could get involved in? Each of us is called to some work. And our ultimate joy and fulfillment, yes, freedom, will come in our obedience to that mission. Paradox number 4. We have to understand the evil in ourselves before we can truly embrace the good in life. He adds to that, until we understand our propensity to do wrong, we never achieve the ability to do the right thing. So, you know, we really do have to see ourselves for what we really are, and that, of course, can be depressing in itself. But, you know, we've got to work our way through it, which takes time. And may take help as well, but we can get there. We have to understand the evil in ourselves before we can truly embrace the good life. So in conclusion, depression can strike anybody, short-term or long-term. Men in particular are prone to depression, and when they are, they often find it hard to talk about it. I've got to give a final plug to the book, haven't I? I don't want to talk about it, you know. Got to remember the title of this sermon. I don't want to talk about it. Well, I did talk about it for over an hour. So anybody else can too. The issues men face are often best talked over with other men, according to what is written in these books, because men do share these things in common. There are steps which we can take to try to alleviate the depression, but often it just takes time before a person comes right again. And often it helps to seek counsel in dealing with it. So, well, I hope I didn't depress you all too much. And just a reminder to the young adult that at 3 o'clock we'll start the Bible study. And to the rest, don't forget the Thanksgiving lunch next week. I'm already hungry just thinking about it. And I will see you all then.